Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben, you are listening to episode 109 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. This week featuring a chat I had with American photographer Ed Pinar, who I shall introduce properly in a minute or two. How's it going? You alright? I think I'm okay. I'm a bit tired. I just got back from Arles, from the Photo Festival in the south of France, which was celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And I'd never been before, so I thought it might be a good excuse to get over there and see what it's all about. I did think it would be a good opportunity to maybe get a couple of chats in the can, and I did manage to get one. The conditions were somewhat challenging, should we say. It's not the best place to do them, to be honest, because it is pretty chaotic in a way. I had fun. I saw and hung out with some really good people. I bumped into a number of friends of the podcast. I made a few new friends. I saw some photography, though not that much. And I got absolutely bitten to death by some very hungry mosquitoes. And all this happened in the grip of this crazy heatwave they're having in Europe, which made everything and everyone very, very, very hot. Which are conditions, frankly, incompatible with walking around an airless exhibition space trying to appreciate photographs. I think the level of air conditioning was a major factor in how well the work was received in many cases, which is, you know, it's not right, is it, when you think about it? But, you know, if there's a massive fan on the floor and it's 40 degrees in there, you're probably going to stand around a bit longer. Anyway, I digress. I don't know what I'm saying. I did record material for an Arles special, which may or may not be the next episode of this podcast. It depends. Wait a second, let me do this first. Don't forget, if you're a regular listener and you think this podcast is worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, that's like £5 a month in English money, please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/smallvoice. Please leave a good review on iTunes. Don't leave a negative one. Why would you do that? And also, if you don't think this is a good podcast, just email me and tell me why, so that others may find out about it. And if you should happen to be in need of a new website, let me know. I'll do you one, Squarespace, blah, 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 all that stuff. So, yeah, I have not yet listened back to what I have. Some of it is definitely okay and hopefully amusing and entertaining. Some of it may not make sense. Some of it may be just pointless gibberish. It's certainly lacking in a number of areas, but as long as I can make it entertaining, none of that really matters. So I will have a listen and make a decision about whether to release an Arles special. Vote now with the buttons in front of you by pressing the blue button if you do want to hear the Arles special, regardless of its dubious quality, and the red button if you don't. I know you haven't really got a button, it's just a kind of illusion. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Excellent Charcoal Book Club, the first and only Book of the Month club, dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every occasion. Each book arrives signed by the artist, along with a note card and a print from an esteemed guest curator, with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. Don't know what's coming this month, but I'm looking forward to it. I'll have to check, but whatever it is, I'll let you know. It will be good. Speaking of books, so I also took my new and possibly or possibly not improved photo book dummy along with me to Arles to show to people, with the intention of recording their comments, as I did for the Chico review special back in March. Those of you who have been following the ongoing saga of my book dummy will know what the score is there. If you don't have a clue what I'm on about, that's totally fine. Just ignore this bit. I'll introduce Ed Pinar in a second. So I did record one or two comments, and I did show it to a bunch of people whose comments I didn't record. And it continues to be an interesting but chastening experience. Frankly, I'm feeling a bit beaten up by it all right now. Justifiably or not, I don't know. But the point of it, as is always the case with a small voice, in case it needs to be reiterated, is to try and offer you, the listener, some potentially useful insights that you might be able to learn from and act upon yourself now or in the future. So, yeah. Well, anyway, We'll see what happens. This episode is sponsored by the equally excellent Finder.me, F-I-N-D-R.me, which is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And in stark contrast to some of their larger competitors, the good people at Finder care about you as a photographer and are committed to total transparency in the way that they do business. Finder is for everyone in the photography business, from wedding planners to artists. And if you are a photographer, regardless of which type of photographer you may be, go and open an account, start filling out your profile. You can do it slowly but surely. Open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients, and finding new opportunities. Join up for free at Finder.me and get your but found. So American photographer Ed Ponar has a BA from the Indiana University of Pennsylvania and an MFA from the Cranbrook Academy of Art in Michigan. He's published several photo books, including In the Vicinity in 2018, Animals That Saw Me, Volumes 1 and 2, Nothing Changes If Nothing Changes, Salad Days, Same Difference, and Golden Palms. And all of those books are linked to in the show notes. Now, Ed, to quote from a piece by Aaron Rothman in Places Journal, is a compiler of small moments, a celebrant of the everyday. Nothing dramatic happens in his photographs. Nowhere exotic is shown. Rather, his prosaic images force us into a sustained encounter with the ordinariness of urban life, bringing together both meanings of the word pedestrian. In his ongoing body of work Out West, Ponar reveals the fluidity of the interaction between the banal and the beautiful. Ponar also has a series Back East that produces a similar effect. Some of the photos do indeed display the striking beauty of Western landscapes, but even this is contained within the bounds of ordinary life. Ponar's views are the kind you might have walking home from somewhere not far away, if you were to take that little detour that goes up the hill just a bit. We are a long way here from the majestic waterfalls and granite domes in Ansel Adams' work. Ponar's photos seem to be saying that if we pay attention, there is no need to venture far and wide, to scale the peaks or traverse the wilds, that something of value is just around the next corner. End quote. Ed's photographs have been exhibited widely, including at venues such as the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, the New York Photography Festival, the Cleveland Museum of Art, and at Pier 24 Photography in San Francisco. Ed is co-founder, along with his partner photographer Melissa Catanese, of the Project Space and photography bookshop Spaces Corners in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he currently lives and works. So, I hadn't listened to this since we recorded it at the Chico Portfolio Review several months ago. I have to say, whilst I was editing this, I really enjoyed the hell out of listening to Ed Ponar, who is a super nice bloke, so I hope you do too. Actually, you are a designer, aren't you, by trade?
I have some background in it. You know, like I always never felt as good as my other designer friends. So I've always been a little bit, you know.
But it was graphic design. Was that your training?
It's a little bit of a hodgepodge. So I did like my undergraduate program. It was the degree was like interdisciplinary fine arts. So it sort of meant I could pick and choose my from a, you know, a few different topics. So it was graphic design, photography, and printmaking. So like those are the three sort of
right.
So I did take some formal design I had a great design teacher, you know, and design to me was like just discovering design as a thing, you know, like that was sort of like a revelation. I was like, oh, all these things, you know, or the having that moment of an undergrad is like, oh wow, everything is designed.
Thought about.
Everything has been designed some way. Even the undesigned is designed, you know. It's like that was a revelation, and like starting to look at topography and type and like seeing that as like conscious or unconscious decisions as it may be.
But then that sort of stood you in good stead as a photographer in a way, because you can, as we were like, you know, that thing about putting a map on the page that's clearly too small, you know, if I was a graphic designer, I probably wouldn't have done that. I probably would have gone, no, that needs to be full pat, you know,
right?
Because you're just used to it.
It definitely helped. Absolutely. And it's funny though, because most of the work I have done in the past with design initially was more web-based, actually, so not print, you know, so it's funny enough. But I was just like, you know, coming from looking at magazines and music, you know, an album, like to me that was like design was like the secret key of like, wow, this is how you make those things, you know, especially in the early days of computing, which when I was at college, like, you know, it was still pretty you know, Photoshop, there was no class yet, you know, like you could, you were kind of self, I was self-taught, you know, like on the software, because it wasn't any actual courses available yet, but it was available, it was available, but still kind of becoming disseminated in like part of the curriculum. So it was sort of a hybrid, like it was sort of a strange time, I guess.
But then you, at some point you elected to pursue the photography. When did that happen?
Well, I think, you know, there's a few probably key moments of that. You know, the photography was always like this component of my interests in activity from like high school days, you know, just like me and friends sort of playing, you know, the camera as like a tool to just sort of play, especially like, again, this like the, you know, mid 90s era where it was like to be able to make your own media, you know, which is now like completely taken for granted and like so easy to do with the phone and internet and YouTube, all that. Like, you know, before that, like you had to get, you know, a $1,500 VHS camcorder and like, you know, all these different tools. Like, so photography was one of those accessible entries. It's like having a roll of film, going out with your friends, making some weird photos and seeing it a week later at the drugstore was very exciting. So it was always part of my interest initially. But it was like after undergraduate, I moved to San Francisco to work at a design agency for a little while. And that's when I actually met Todd Heido, and I was taking like night classes there, and kind of there was no color darkroom where I had studied, so I was like learning color printing from Todd. Actually,
it was really interesting. So he was teaching you how to actually print color, which is quite unusual.
Yeah, and the first class I took with him was actually like a portfolio presentation class, you know. So it was like this like interesting idea of like how to actually assemble something from photographs, which was just a foreign concept to me. Like that was the first time I started to think about
that you could put them together.
Exactly, and what that entails.
So when I
lost my job at the design firm, I was one of the first casualties of the dot-com bubble bursting. And that's when I think that was the moment I switched more formally to thinking of like making photography more central in my, you know, life basically. And didn't know what that meant. I did know that I just never really had much interest in commercial photography and not much, you know.
Yeah. So you didn't see yourself as going down the path of being a kind of jobbing photographer for hire. You wanted to work on your own projects.
Correct. Yeah.
Which you have done.
Yeah. I'm still working on. Yeah. Totally.
So Todd must have been a very kind of quite an important early inspiration.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He was, I mean, in that whole time period for me was like, that was like my first, like, yeah, you know, feels like, you know, entering the world or something, especially from like the kind of isolated sort of, you know, Western Pennsylvania factory town. And my college that I went to was very close to that. And, you know, hadn't really spent much time away from that area my whole life. Like we didn't really travel much as a child, like hadn't even been to New York City, I think, at that point.
You know? That's where you grew up.
I did. Yes. Mm. So California was like this in 100 ways, like this, you know, wide world opening. And also in particular photography, because I didn't have access to these things. Like there was no bookstores or, you know, places where I could browse these things. And then, of course, Todd, you know, yeah, absolutely was instrumental in like bringing all these photo books in.
Cool. What kind of people did he sort of turn you on to then? Larry Sultan, people like that?
I mean, it was really, I mean, for me, it was honestly everything, because I had like very, again, like sort of like, you know, in college, which I actually went to with Chris McCall. So we actually
from met Pier 24. In that time.
Yeah, exactly. We were there and we somehow stumbled upon a few things. Like he had a Wolfgang Tillmann's Berg, you know, like that was like one of the first photo books that I remember actually, you know, looking at it and thinking. My first photo book purchase was Nick Woplington's like Safety in Number, you know. Wow. So I had a few, and I was, to me, that was really interesting because there was so little, it felt at that time there was very little photography that I could see that was showing the world as it was at that time, you know, like it was, that's why magazines seemed actually more relevant and important to actually, if you wanted to see something contemporary, that was the location for that. So Todd, I mean, I didn't even know about William Eggleston until Todd's class, right, you know, for example, or Joel Stern, you know, so I feel like the whole kind of lineage of photography that I had, you know, at that point been, you know, I think more or less already sort of interested in it on a certain level, but not realizing it. You know, I was kind of wanted to photograph a place. I wanted to make images in my hometown. You know, I wanted to photograph the world around me, but I didn't real. I wasn't, you know, and I still feel like I'm a student of, in, you know, of the medium in that way, where I'm still kind of learning more about these artists and kind of filling in the blanks. And it's been kind of a gradual, ongoing process. But I remember he took apart the Robert Frank American's book, so we saw the sequence on the table, and that was like a revelation.
He physically took it apart.
So it was like kind of incredible to actually be able to see those connections and like to view it as like this long kind of thread that was really interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of seminal text as far as the sequencing goes, isn't it? Everyone refers to the Americans constantly.
Absolutely.
I suppose it is the most famous of all photo books. So the kind of precariousness of the life then is something that you've always kind of been very much you know, aware of. And tried to, you know, not worry too much about, I guess. What's your sort of
strangely
philosophy towards that?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like somehow I, through I think a bit of, you know, ignorance, especially early on, and just like, you know, just being naive or something, or and or just being stubborn, I think, you know, like I was somehow, you know, I was like, this will all work out somehow. You know, I never really, you know, I still have yet to really feel like I've figured anything out. You know, I'm always sort of on the walking the line of, you know, the edge of financial collapse is always in sight.
Right. Yeah.
If not, actually, I'm already there, which I don't realize. But I don't know. It's maybe it's the thing in the States here where it's like, you know, you just, you have to adapt to that. Like going to graduate school, you know, going to everything is just so expensive. Like, you know, and having zero health care is just like, you just live with these things. You just have to, because there's just, I don't have that many other choices in certain regards with that. Or like, I knew at a certain point, like, okay, if I want to have like a more stable, more predictable, more, you know, balanced sort of life, perhaps I have to maybe probably do something I didn't want to do or didn't know how to do in my own way. And so I was always, you know, tended to, and I think through design that gave me a little bit of a flexibility. So I felt like, okay, I can do something freelance and like actually make a little bit of a living and figure out a way. And you know, my strategy has always been, and it continues to be, is like, you know, as I'm not going to increase my earnings, like I need to just decrease my spending, you know, and just like find a nice little, and you know, luckily I'm not a very materialistic person other than like camera things and books, you know, like I'm not really buying, I never owned a car. I've never had a, you know, which is very strange in America.
You don't cover a new BMW or some nice expensive clothes. Though those things would be, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is about that balance between, you know, the freedom to pursue the work that you want to do.
Absolutely.
And you know, and the compromise that are involved in earning a living. So you've sort of tried to tread that path. I was reading an interview with you that you did in, I think, 2013, and you were talking about this stuff, and I was thinking, well, let's see how things have progressed in the last 6 years from then. But you seem to be making it work, and you live in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely.
Partly because you did live in New York at one point, which is obviously a ferociously expensive place to live, a bit like London.
Absolutely.
So I imagine that Pittsburgh's a little more affordable.
100%. That was really a massive draw. You know, I mean, it is close to where I grew up, and it was close to the area I wanted to be making photographs in as well. So that was, you know, bonus, really. I feel lucky to be from an area that I love to photograph. And I guess perhaps I would be from wherever I was from. But yeah, New York, you know, really kind of drove it home, like, I just couldn't see a path to making, you know, the amount of money that was required in that, and the sacrifices that seemed to be made just to achieve a position, just being there, you know, like that, let alone, you know, I know, and it seemed like it was a lifelong commitment. That's what New York seemed like to me.
Yeah.
It's like,
and I think you said, you know, it's like, you know, it's very stressful if you don't know how you're going to pay your bill. It's like, how can you, you know, going out to shoot pictures feels a little kind of self-indulgent if you've got a bill coming that you can't really pay. So you don't want that, you know, you don't want to feel that way.
Yeah, it's really, you know, and I do think that's why it's like partly, you know, so it's almost like maybe a psychology of repression I've had to adopt, you know, in order to accept, like, because I'm almost always, you know, I think right now I've got $48 in my bank account right now. And I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, I'm so broke and I have like some big savings though, or some other type of, you know, I have like literally that's it.
Sounds to me like my
no assets.
Well, I like,
but that, with that being said, we do like with my partner, Melissa, and that's something that really, you know, us working together over these years has really also been instrumental. And I do know that it would have been a lot harder for anybody to do this on their own. You know, she's mostly in my boat as well, but through us being together, we've been able to help each other and, you know, afford things that I could never have done on our own. Like now we do own our building in Pittsburgh, for example.
Right.
You know, we have like, but we figured, so we found somehow a way to, you know, to keep or to create a baseline of stability that is, you know, I'm grateful for every day. So it's like, I know I'm not going to, and I could, if I needed to, I could go back to McDonald's where I used to work as a teenager and work and pay the bills, you know, so there's that feeling that my expenses and overhead are low enough that I could, you know, it's definitely manageable.
Well, yeah, I think I like what you said. I think in that same interview that, you know, you try and focus on the things that you can do rather than worrying about the things that you can't do.
Yes.
Is that an important kind of approach for you?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think that's like, that's also been maybe my MO or somehow, if I figured anything out, it's that, like, you know, how to kind of keep going no matter what. And I think Todd maybe instilled that in me. That's like sort of work ethic of like, just have to get it done. You have to find a way.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, you know, make it now, you know, make things, ask questions later kind of thing. And also working with the tools you have, you know, so working, I've always been a kind of economical photographer in a way, like where, you know, I have very simple equipment, very simple tools that are not terribly expensive, and that I'm able to find a way to use those things to achieve what I want, you know, knowing that, oh, if only I had this lens or that camera or this format, you know, but okay, I don't. So what can I do? Exactly. That's always been a guiding principle.
Well, you said it. I mean, the phrase that I was going to use was work ethic, because you seem to have that, in the sense that you always want to have something going, right? Do you feel like you need to kind of keep your eye in, as it were, and always be shooting?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, for me, it's like exercising, you know, for shooting and editing as well. Like, it's something I want to do constantly. I feel like I'll never do enough of, you know, I'm never feeling like, oh, there's always more. Like, oh, you should go out there. You know, like the kind of feeling of like always wanting to actually do more. And, you know, but yeah, it's like, you know, shooting constantly. I mean, it comes in waves, you know, so there are periods where I'll shoot a lot less. And then there are periods where I'm like more excited about certain things, or just, you know, it's also time and space. So it's like this, you know, as we all know, I think this juggling act of life is always providing new challenges.
Yeah. Well, you know, because like you say, I mean, mentioning Todd in relation to, you know, the advocating the work ethic, I mean, just watching him this week and the way that he prioritizes his time to shoot is mind-blowing. It's like,
absolutely.
You know that guy, we're all sitting here now, it's snowing, which is very lovely, but you know Todd's, he's out there shooting,
absolutely.
You know he is.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you know,
he's in it.
Yeah, it's like, wow, that's really inspiring, because I haven't spoken to him yet. I will ask him about that.
Yes.
So what was the first sort of set of pictures you started putting together? Well, what was the first book? Let's look at it that way.
Well, it's funny, because the first group of pictures I started working with, which actually was in Todd's class, was like one of the first, you know, we're all, and it's an ongoing project that has yet to become a book, actually, is my photographs from my hometown called Walking. The series is now called Walking Home. So that has been like the series that's always been like at the center, and like the series I had used to apply for graduate school, for example, even though it's like not yet a realized final project. And then interestingly, my first book project became work that I had been making in Los Angeles. Because I had, after I was in San Francisco for a few years and I was doing a design job, my one and only salary job experience. and that economy crashed, you know, one of the things that happened was that I moved to LA, you know, so partly because I had never been there. And like, and when you're in Northern California, you hear murmurs of this, you know, foreign, strange city to the south that most people speak of disparagingly and negatively. And I just got very, very curious. I'm like, wait a minute, there's like millions of people there. Like, it's got, you know, what's going on? You know, what's it like?
Yeah.
And it was an you know, I'd spent enough time in San Francisco, felt like a good time to, and I had another opportunity. A friend was like, hey, come live with me. And then, even though we left like a month later, but so I spent some, you know, I ended up living in LA for, you know, about 2 years, and another year after that on and off for part of the time. And so it was photographs from that time period actually that became my very first book.
Okay, right.
Golden Palms.
Golden Palms, right. I wanted to ask you about editing and the process and sequencing, I suppose, as well. But it's one of those mysterious subjects that it's like trying to hold water in your hand or something, isn't it?
Yes.
Talking about it. But I know it's an important part of the process for you. So maybe you can sort of talk a little bit about why that is.
Sure. Yeah, and I think, you know, I do think about editing a lot, obviously, bookmaking requires that. And I also think about how editing is a constant part of the photographic process, you know, like the editing, to me, the editing starts when, you know, you're framing something one way instead of another, or looking one direction or one location rather than another, you know, like that to me is like the beginning of this editing, the decision process is kind of happening at that stage, which I feel like is it always a type of editing? And I think it is, you know, almost impossible to talk about editing in the end because it is this weird, nebulous, strange process. And that when it's done right, I feel like it's almost like audio engineering or something. It's something you don't want to notice, you know, you don't think about. And it's like maybe difficult to extract, or you can't like take it apart from the thing itself. It becomes the thing itself. So that's how I think about editing is like, really the goal for me as when creating an edit or a sequence is like feeling like, this is somehow now its own thing, or like a new thing has been made that's now somehow has its own coherence or cohesion. And I feel like the editing is like a process of trying to attempt to get to that point.
Because I was going to ask you about that, because I wrote down the challenge of creating a narrative or sense of a cohesive whole with fairly abstract, seemingly what did I write there? Fucking hell. Wait a sec. Seemingly unrelated individual pictures. And then I was reading in the preparation this interview you did, and here's a question. Great minds think alike. Photography feels... This is Benjamin Thomas.
Oh, yes.
Photography feels like it's going through a change where the structure required to create a body of images is being questioned or consciously disregarded. Imagery can feel disparate, non-linear, or unconnected, but still be gathered together to form one piece of work, even if a lot of the links are at first unclear. This has always been present, but seems to be more prevalent now. I understand how you do this when you're making the projects that are clearly about one place, but how do you go about constructing narrative or cohesion in projects such as Same Difference or Relics? The possibilities of what you can photograph with these projects seem endless. Is this not overwhelming? So thank you very much to Benjamin because he basically crystallized the exact question that I had.
Excellent. Yeah.
Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It is an interesting challenge. I think I think what it is thinking of the editing as, you know, as an important of an authorial sort of practice as, you know, whatever it is that makes one photographer make certain images rather than another. I feel like the combining and the thought process and then therefore the philosophy, and I think that underlies that kind of comes out somehow or part of that approach. And I think that's, you know, to me the difference, and I think it's something that we all get stuck on, or, you know, it's like the confusion thing for a lot of people outside of the photography realm. It's like, well, why are these things together? Why? And it's a great question, and there's not always a clear answer, but the answer, you know, has to be answered by the project, you know, by the kind of, you know, the desire to put something together that's this one specific thing. In those projects that he mentioned, Same Difference in another series of mine called Relics, like they're sort of meant to be disparate, or like Same Difference in particular was like this idea for me was to, you know, with, there is this, you know, interest in like creating something that's like of a place or something that's very logical or cohesive and something that's like somehow makes sense. And then I wanted to know if I could make pictures that had no connection to be the sense that connected them somehow, you know, so that was sort of an exercise of, and also I've been, you know, always really interested in ambient music and this kind of non-narrative sort of form that's what I think of when I think of that is this sort of like, you know, more atmospheric, and it's like in crafting it deliberately with the idea to kind of resist any one sort of flow, but yeah, somehow still have like a piece of ambient music that's successful, like, and, you know, encourages your mind to sort of roam or sort of creates a space in which you want to be in that is somehow distinct and unique, even though it feels like it could have been, you know, in theory, maybe 100 other different pictures, or it could be infinite. But also the limit is sometimes, you know, I have what I have to work from. So I'm more also, you know, the archive is, you know, I'm always, that's why I'm always, I feel like it's like this gardening activity or something where you're kind of always planting seed, but some of them will reap more interesting things. Some of them will just kind of be forgotten. You know, some of them, you know, you spend more time on and they develop into something more extravagant than you could have imagined, but you're kind of working from this sort of same ground, like the archive.
Yeah, yeah. So, but do you tend to have, a number of different projects kind of all percolating, all going along at once, as it were? So
I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because things like, so for instance, with Animals That Saw Me, those pictures were taken over a long period of time.
Yes.
You didn't go, oh, I'm going to do a project about animals.
Correct.
You went at some point, oh, wow, I've got all these pictures of animals, you know. How interesting. Yes. So, yeah, can you sort of talk a little about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, it's like goes back to this idea of sort of tending to the garden or something. Like, I feel like there is this, you know, I want to keep my shooting as open as possible, and I'm just excited to be any place and just with a camera and without having to be like, what is this for? What am I doing here? And, you know, I feel like I'm just trying to respond to the world as it presents itself at that moment. And then with the idea and knowing that, all, you know, photographs are always mysterious, they're always this kind of open-ended things, and that the patterns emerge after further reflection and just kind of after having done that process for so long. So Animals That Saw Me was this... And also, I love, for me, this, Animals That Saw Me, like, I'm collecting through my archive, I have a stack of photographs of animals. So, like, that's, like, a basic way of me organizing things. I just, like, have kind of almost really generic categories just to kind of start to give some sort of sense. But in those animals photographs, I started to notice this distinct subgroup where the animals seemed to really be engaged with me or to say to really had been somehow... There's a moment, there was an interaction of sort that was, and then I, you know, the title sealed the deal when I came up with that way of describing those photographs and like inverting that, like, you know.
Yeah. Not that you saw them, but that they saw you.
Exactly. Yeah. And then sometimes, you know, when I have like that discovery or idea about a specific project, it's a pleasant surprise to then go back into the archive and realize like, oh, wow, I've been doing this actually, or this has happened before.
Yeah.
And then also it informs further shooting, you know.
Yeah.
But luckily that's the type of project where I, as much as I want to make as many of those pictures as possible, and perhaps I could stage them or fake them, like, to me, the magic of it was these unexpected encounters and, like, you know, kind of creating the space where that was, like, the focus was a big part of that.
My friend Ian Tay, he's a photographer, he just describes it as stamp collecting, really, you know, the process of collecting images.
Sure.
You know, it's the same thing as collecting stamps or something, you know, you just, and then you put them together in certain ways.
Absolutely.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this thing that you... you spoke about in one of the panels, speculative realism.
Oh, sure.
Because I it's always interesting to hear about, you know, fairly kind of arcane inspirations.
Yes.
So sure. What is this speculative realism thing, and how did you come by it?
Sure. You know, it's I'm trying to remember now how it first emerged, like, you know, somewhere online, you know, and I think it was certainly a phrase. As soon as I saw it, I was like, whoa, what is that? So, and then I think just kind of doing some research, I found my way into this little subworld of the internet. And there was a lot of, this was like in early 2010, 2011. Right, actually, when Animals That Saw Me was coming out as a book. And that's why it's like, it was this sort of like, definitely one of those like profound moments of like connection. You're like, whoa. And specifically, so apparently from what I've gathered, speculative realism emerged, you know, maybe just a few years before that, maybe in the early 2000s. I can't remember the exact date, at some conference. And there's many different branches already. So the specific branch I'm interested in is called object-oriented ontology, OOO. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the phraseology there. And I'm definitely an outsider with these things. So like, which is interesting to me is that, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't come from a heavy theory background. Like, I don't have a lot of, you know, I feel like I know enough to, you know, navigate their texts. And what I love about them is that it's also very accessible text as well. So it's been a constant learning experience since I've come across these, right? And in particular, Graham Harman, Levi Bryant, Timothy Morton, who I had the pleasure of having contribute an essay to The Animals That Saw Me, Volume 2. And those writers just seem to be describing the world in there was a feeling of like describing the intuitions that I was feeling in my work and the way I was interested in photography. So that like resonance like is just stuck with me. And I feel like this, you know, it's something I'm still, you know, I feel like it's just feeding my process and the way I'm thinking about things. And I hope to be able to maybe be hopefully more articulate about this in the future.
So, yeah, what is object-oriented ontology?
I mean, it's, you know, there's a few different components to it, but I think one of the most essential things is this idea of this decentering of the human, you know, like where, you know, they would say that most philosophy, Western philosophy up to that point had been, you know, basically, you know, the world doesn't exist only in the mind, you know, like it's how we think about it was what matters, like how things appear to humans is like the central thing that matters most, and which makes sense since we are human, of course, but saying that that doesn't, you know, you basically are excluding a lot of the world and you're basically kind of writing off of a lot. And to me, that's what photography is, like this engagement with the world, with things in the world. And I felt like for, you know, Animals That Saw Me, like that was the whole kind of sort of concept there. It was like, what do we look like from them, you know, for them, you know, what is the world that we take for granted look like to all these other things that are, we're sharing the world with, you know, like I always think about, you know, street photography minus, you know, or it's like normally thought of as like, oh, the people on the street. But, you know, if you took all the people out of a city, there's still a lot of things left, to look at and a lot to talk about. And those things have lives too, I think. And so, and I feel like it's, whether I knew it or not at the time, that's been like something that I've always been consciously driven towards or exploring in my photography. So it kind of gave me a new toolkit to kind of access those ideas and to think about how, or, you know, and also to me, because it is, I think so much photography is judged on, well, this isn't about people, or as if that, then it doesn't matter, you know, and like, you know, and I've always not, you know, I've always been interested in photographs of place. And, you know, I've kind of come up with, you know, a framework where I feel like I'm still fleshing out, but like, I feel like in photography, there's almost, or from reading and learning about this idea of realism, and speculative realism is also about like, you know, this idea of, being able to try to this activity of imagining the world from these different perspectives you know, even though it is of course impossible, we're still in the realm of our heads of humans. But the fact is that there is a world out there, you know, there are asteroids now circling us that we're not aware of, and they don't need us to be aware of them to exist, you know. So this whole idea of like, I think I've always liked things that sort of like put humans in a, like, you know, one of many ways of experiencing things.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's kind of an antidote to the arrogance of humanity that we sort of, for some reason, decide that we're the most important thing, which is, absolutely, as you say, you know, fundamentally not necessarily true.
Absolutely.
But yeah, and also I think this idea of becoming inspired by things outside of photography,
yes,
you know, is really interesting. And it's always interesting to hear people talk about, you know, inspirations,
yes,
that feed into the photography, but which aren't necessarily photographic.
Right.
Are there any other things that you listen to, music and that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, music, you know, I think like most of us, you know, it's like absolutely essential, you know, like just as like from the formative years of like that being some of the first creative expression that I was really connected with, to how, and then in all the things that involves, you know, like I love how music becomes, like somebody made it, it's a recording, you know, it's, even if it's live, you know, it's something that was, it's, you're looking at a, you know, a replica or a copy of something that had occurred. But it also can become yours, you know, everyone makes music maybe more than many mediums, you know, like it's, you know, it's somehow to your soundtrack, to your life, even though someone wrote that for maybe a very different reason, a very different time period, you know? So I love that kind of resonance. And also like photography as well, like how music inadvertently can capture something of that era, you know, not necessarily trying to say, hey, this is what is happening, but it's even also, of course, sometimes doing that very specifically, but it, you know, it's always sort of reveal, you know, how you can look at it and think about like this sort of, you know, you can, you know, read all these other things into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, it's funny actually, like I remember actually as a child, like I, you know, kind of, you know, being fascinated by, like, again, this noticing this difference, like, oh, you know, the kids in my catechism class, you know, like, oh, I listen to heavy metal, I'm like the devil's child or something. And I, to me, I'm like, look, no, they're actually talking about Christ right here. You know, like, I, like how, you know, being aware of like how like appearances can be misleading, how, you know, ideas about things can be inaccurate. Somehow like music was like a, you know, that, and also that teenage sort of, I guess, rebelliousness, you know, how like you're presenting something, but you knew it meant something else. You know, I don't know, this kind of, those things sort of float around in there for me.
Tell me about Salad Days. Was that an early project? Because that's I kind of came to mind when you're talking about capturing a certain time, you know, is that, I guess it's relevant to that. Can you speak a little about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is really the first photographs, more or less, you know, I was making. And it was, you know, I was an amateur, you know, 100%. Like there was no, like photography was supposed to just record what happened.
Right. You know? Well, you've talked about the accidental quality of the amateur. Yes. You know, so yeah, sorry, carry on.
Oh, no, no. You know, and I think that's always been something, you know, like that, you know, and I think what most, you know, many photographers strive for this sort of like kind of, you know, it's, you know, trying to get back to something that, you know, is unconscious or subconscious, you know, even though, of course, the more you think about it, the harder that is, and the more difficult that can be. So it was this sort of ground zero for me of like understanding the difference between a photograph and a moment, and how photography can be trickery and also can be a letdown or be an unexpected surprise. You know, sometimes the most boring or unsuspecting moment was the most interesting photograph. And then sometimes the most interesting moment did not make it into the photo. You know, so just starting to think about what happened or what is or isn't there, and how the camera was seeing or creating a world that was different from the actual moment, even though it was still part, you know, so it was a way of, you know, kind of, you know, I feel like there was this kind of naive realism to photography, you know, where we just have this expectation where it's just like, and this is where it gets a little bit, I mean, I can go into that separately.
No, go ahead.
Well, I am sort of developing this notion where based on my inspirations from reading up these sort of, you know, and maybe just like partly, you know, someone who's much more intelligent than I could probably destroy my framework here, but which I love about the arts though, like we have this freedom to like, to be delusional basically.
Yeah.
But anyway, that being said, you know, this idea of like, maybe there's three different types of realisms of photography. You know, naive realism being this baseline where it either is what it is, or even in a photojournalistic sense, where like, hey, wow, look how horrible things are. You have to change now because of that, because now you can see that. It's like based on this idea of a photograph showing you something, and that is what it is. You know, whether it was an unconscious thing of the family snapshots, we're celebrating, we're supposed to be photographing, you know, or that other idea. Or also, you know, same thing where it's like, it is what it is. A photograph is what it, you know, showing you. There's no question about it. You know, then there's like the flip side of that is the anti-realism. I mean, it's obviously a very big tradition in against photography. Like, oh, just showing us the world, you're not doing anything. There's nothing happening there. It's not art. It's not interesting. Don't show me what I've already seen, you know, or, you know, so it's like resisting or going against, you know, but it's still kind of based on this idea that it could do that, you know, which I think that's where the third element comes in, speculative realism, which is a, maybe not using it in totally the same way they are, but this idea that, okay, it's kind of a little bit of both. Or photography cannot show you, or the world cannot be reproduced in a photograph. A photograph is a unique thing that somehow relates to the world in perhaps an interesting way. And then questioning, using it as a way to question that reality in a very kind of, you know, deliberate manner. So it's sort of like accepting the failure of photography to actually do something very concrete or specific. So it's that's a framework I'd like to flesh out further, but that's kind of like a loose, I've been thinking about it. And I feel like thinking about photography in that way, there's a lot of, you know, different, you could categorize things very interestingly, and so, you know, breaks out of some of the normal traditional genres as well, because I feel like there's a lot of documentary style, to me was the beginning of that. I feel like that's what he was talking about. Like, it's not a replica of the world and that's it. It's actually based in reality, but actually then becomes something totally different, and allow, you know, it becomes a tool for other things to happen. So,
Well, because I was going to ask you about Same Difference, which you sort of described as a kind of an anti-project in a way.
Sure, yeah.
So, so that in a way is kind of follows on from what you're saying.
Sure,
here.
Yes.
And you sort of you move quite sort of fluidly between color and black and white. This was a black and white project, but yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about that one.
Sure. Or do you mean Nothing Change? Oh, Nothing
oh,
Changes.
Well, I'm, where am I now? Changes. I'm at Nothing Changes. Yes. Sorry, no.
No, yeah, no, no, no. Similar though. Very. They're. I feel like those, like Relics, Same Difference, Nothing Changes,
right,
are
right,
these
right.
projects that are mixing things and not, you know, they're more guided by a feeling or kind of a yeah, a interest in creating a sort of ambient sort of
right.
atmosphere.
Yeah, which I think is a kind of your defining, you know, style in a way, or your kind of USP. I mean, it's what you do. And it goes back to this earlier thing we were saying about, you know, creating something from disparate elements.
Yes.
So Walking Home isn't yet a book, but that's the one that you've been shooting for a long time.
Yes.
And walking is as an important part of your process, is it?
100%.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Has that always been the case for you?
It has. Like, I mean, I grew up never having a car of my own. And I grew up in, I guess, you know, somehow in towns and places where walking was not that crazy, which in the States is not always
normal. Well, I was going to say,
normal.
Yeah, in America, it can be an extraordinary, I mean, you know,
yes.
other countries, it's like, oh yeah, especially if you're in a big city, you know.
Totally.
But, I suppose in New York is a great walking city, but
absolutely.
The rest of the country, would be thought of extremely weird if you haven't got a car. Yeah, right?
Absolutely. But I think, you know, my hometown was sort of like this old, you know, these older towns in the East, you know, they had this infrastructure for pedestrians, you know, like one of my subsets of photographs from that I'm photographing where I live in Pittsburgh, there are these, you know, incredible, like 700 different sets of public staircases, like going up and down the hills and in the forest now, and like in neighborhoods that are sparsely populated, and just like seemed like they're from this era when, you know, well, public works actually mattered, but also where pedestrian people were wandering around, and that actually was an important thing. So yeah, I grew up, you know, walking a lot. My dad used to walk to work, you know, from, you know, he was a walker, you know,
yeah,
so I think we were
as
all,
well.
There was like, you know, it was just something that I was doing all the time. And in every place I lived, I always loved kind of walking, exploring. And I think I just love being out in,
what's your sort of typical self-talk when you're walking along? Is it, you know, do you find it meditative, or are you sort of self-flagellatory in your self-talk? Because, you know, I think a lot of us are. You
right,
know,
yeah.
This sort of, you know, this kind of, like,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Do you remember Muttley out of the Wacky Races?
No,
you're not
know.
Old enough. But anyway, this sort of, you know, constant, you know, grouching or whatever.
Nice, yeah.
But yeah, no, I presume you're a little more positive than that.
Yeah, it could, I mean, it could, that can, I'm sure that's been, those walks have happened as well. But no, I definitely think of it as more of a walking meditation type of thing where I'm just interested in being in a place. And the Walking Home project in particular, of course, is a very specific place. You know, it's this place I've been walking my whole life. You know, I still visit where my childhood home, where my parents still live, you know, so I'm like seeing, you know, how, you know, similar how you, when you go home as an adult, you know, you're seeing yourself change. You're seeing the place change, and like being on foot all those years, you know, I used to have a paper route when I was a teen as well. So like, you know, delivering newspapers, walking through the neighborhood, you know, this was all, you know, instrumental to my, you know, upbringing and how my experience of the world was. Like, it was just sort of essential.
Well, there is something surreal about going back to your childhood home.
Absolutely.
And realizing that, you know, of course it's changed, but then again, it sort of hasn't changed.
Yes.
And you have changed because suddenly you're an adult and,
exactly.
You know, yeah, so there's all that going on.
Yes.
Do you know, is that something you're trying to convey in some way?
I think it's definitely, or, you know, to me, it separates that project from my other works, you know, because even though I'm photographing other places I live, of course, even though I don't live there anymore, like, it's the place I have the most deep kind of rooted connection to. And it was from living in different parts of the States that I was able to see different parts of that landscape differently. Like moving to California, seeing the prosperity and the wealth and the beauty and the natural environment, like that was like a complete like revelation, you know, and then coming back and realizing, wow, things are kind of not doing, you know, when I first moved out there, it was like, you know, it was in the end of the 90s, you know, everything was like, it was like the best time ever for the U.S. economy, but not where I was from. You know, I had never seen anything except economic decline growing up. So like seeing that kind of disparity, that was definitely a big part of that experience of like rethinking home. And then, of course, like, you know, well, this is just one of these places that, you know, like many, many, many places in the States that are just been completely forgotten, completely left behind, completely like, you know, had a history that, you know, that was built up, obviously, and that, you know, created these beautiful buildings that were then, you know, somehow just being erased, you know, like the entire place seemed to be erased, you know, just, and, you know, think about how there was no clear answer, you know, there was no explanation that was satisfying of why this is happening, especially when I had, you know, I had some international friends at college and years after that, you know, it's like, how, why are these places this way? Like, what happened? You know, it's like, it was difficult to explain, like, and it's, you know, and when you're from these places, you really feel like it's, you know, you're just out of luck or like it's your fault or something, you know, you feel like, you know, it's just not a, you know, it's a difficult and kind of, you know, challenging kind of experience. So I did want to show, I mean, I wanted to show all of that, you know, and I wanted to show the town itself. And I wanted to kind of, you know, have the town as the character, you know, like, so the place itself and the artifacts. So it's just one of the, you know, I knew from the beginning that I did not want to do portrait work, you know, because I never wanted it to be about specific people. And I thought there was no, for me, there was no way to avoid that. I think, you know, portrait photographers and photographers that work with humans in a more deliberate way, I'm amazed by the ones that can do it so well. And there's so many, obviously, and that with such empathy and such like profound sense of connection. But for me, it felt like it was just too easy for it to become about, you know, a judging of the people that you saw in this place. And I wanted to remove that element so we could all just look and see and think about why can you just go to a place in so-called amazing America and just see this? You know, I'm not going to any place crazy or off the beaten path. And again, these are the streets I grew up on, the streets I had friends on, you know, the paper route streets I had, you know, like the places that I knew as a child that weren't, you know, it didn't feel like that growing up necessarily. Like, I think when I was growing up, it was like the last sort of, you know, the tail end of, you know, I guess, I don't know what you'd call it, like some semblance of stability.
Prosperity.
Or at least some sort of kind of, you know, cohesion to the communities, you know, they weren't completely tattered like they are now.
What sort of kid were you then? What are your memories of that phase in your life? Were you sort of in your head, or what were you like? Did you like school, that kind of stuff?
I didn't, you know, high school wasn't, you know, I wasn't that excited about like most, you know, rebellious, you know, whatever, you know, eschewing authority and, you know, fuck everything. You know? But I was definitely in my own world. And I think this landscape, you know, and like it's in the hills, it's in the kind of forest, like, you know, I'm growing up in a time when it was like we were on our own, you know, like you just go out, you know, you and your friends, you had your own reality, you know, it was like, you know, it was just your world, you know, and like, and then getting on the bike for the first time and like pushing out the boundary to see what was a little further or like what was around the corner, you know, starting to see the, you know, having that freedom to do that, like, so it was a big part of my upbringing and like kind of like creating my own. I was always interested in, you know, having my own stories kind of, and, you know, seeing how, you know, in this, actually, even in the very beginning, I was always like, you know, calendars of Pennsylvania are full of like covered bridges and barns and fall foliage hillsides. And I was like, but where are the empty factories and the broken house? You know, like that was like the landscape. So noticing how we are always sort of trying to look away, like, or you were supposed to ignore what was right in front of you or pretend it wasn't what it was. Like that was also, I think, my draw to photography is like this kind of way to be like, you know, there is some sort of matter of factness to these things and to just looking and to, you know, still, though, you know, trying to, you know, find a way to work within that kind of language of photography to kind of.
Humor is a common thing in your work. You know, it's evident, and you know, and I like that because the photography can get a bit fucking po-faced at times, can't it? You know? I love to see a bit of that, but that's just clearly part of your persona. and you're putting that into the work. But is that a subconscious thing, do you think, or, you know, is it some kind of deliberate effort?
I mean, I think maybe a little both, because I mean, of course, like you said, I think it is my, you know, definitely part of my persona is like, I'm interested in, I've always been interested in humor and absurd humor in particular, and like things, you know, and I think it was maybe a coping mechanism, you know, when you grow up in these places, it's like you feel like you're already at the bottom of the barrel, you know, so it's like there's nowhere to go except this kind of cynical, dark humor, you know, like that was definitely part of, you know, so I'm definitely drawn to that, I think, when it happens and it actually somehow seems to work, you know, which I do think is difficult. And I don't think it's totally conscious, or, you know, it's not something I don't think you can do, like, oh, I'm gonna make a really funny project, you know, it's like like you hope that happens, right. And you, and there has to be other layers, of course, because not everyone has the same sort of sensibility, but I do think I do try to I think it's part of this, you know, idea of lightness as well that I'm really interested in, like we have this kind of, I don't want to, I'm not interested in making heavy-handed statements and kind of like, you know, really I'm not interested in proselytizing about like something that's so specific. I want to make something that has kind of more open, more holes and more porous and more kind of space for the viewer to kind of inhabit and to, you know, kind of in invite them into a certain strange realm or something where, you know, I'm not necessarily dictating what, I mean, even though I am, of course, I'm making something, I'm creating parameters, but I want it to be as open as possible where the viewer is able to have their own experience perhaps. And that's always been my favorite type of work, you know, like work that I feel like I'm invited to into, but I'm not being, you know, hit over the head with, this is what's happening and this is what you're supposed to think, you know, like always something I've resisted.
Yeah, that resonates with me at the moment. I think I'm feeling the same way about the thing I'm doing. Do you enjoy the ambiguity that kind of tends to be inherent in photography? Is that it's something you like to play with? Yeah,
absolutely. It's definitely like, I think it's, to me, it's like, you know, one of the best features of photography. Yeah. You know? I think it goes back to this, my, you know, the speculative realism kind of element. I think that's what that is really. It's sort of like,
no, it's one of the great strengths and joys of it.
Yes.
Let's talk about In the Vicinity, which I think is probably your most recent book. Let's have a look.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's lovely, isn't it? Is that what do you call it? Letterpress?
Foil stamp. Yeah, similar
thing.
Yeah, it is.
And you published this with Deadbeat.
Yes.
Deadbeat Club.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this, because basically it's kind of about weed, isn't it, to some extent?
Yes.
How did it come about?
Well, there's a lot of different threads here, of course. Yeah. but it came about first and foremost because of a childhood friend of mine, actually, that I wandered a lot of those streets walking home with, found himself in Northern California working for a pot farmer. Mm. And he needed a helper. I needed work. It's kind of worked out very nicely. So we had, you know, starting in like 2009, I was visiting him. And I was then starting to work part-time. I would go for spring planting, fall harvests, almost twice a year for almost 10 years. I missed, I think, two of those years for various reasons. But so I was there. Like, it was a job of mine. I was invited into this strange little bubble of, like, completely, you know, it was, to me, this completely bizarro world of, like, rural, idyllic kind of pastoralism that, you know, with this kind of like underlying edge of raw capitalism and like strange, you know, pseudo quasi legal activities happening
over
the years.
Because, I mean, just to sort of set the context for non-American listeners, they have basically decriminalized weed in California.
Absolutely, yes.
But of course, you know, it's one has to get, if other people outside the USA, you have to get your head around the notion that there are federal laws and there are also state laws.
Correct.
So that's a kind of weird dynamic that every American has to somehow carry in their head. So, sorry, I interrupted you, Ed.
No.
Yeah. So it was an attempt to sort of just explore that environment, was it?
It was another, you know, like it was an opportunity for me. Like, most of my projects have been urban based because I've been living in cities most of the time. So this was like, you know, I was I was able to spend a great deal of time in this very rural, very remote location. You know, so it was a very different environment than I had been accustomed to working in. And as usual for me, I'm always sort of like hoping there's many projects for many of my photographs, but I don't have something specifically in mind when I'm beginning something like this. I never thought that it would become a book exactly until, but then after 5 or 6 years, I'm like, oh wow, there's actually something starting to grow here. So
at
this time, most of that time in California was before, they just completely decriminalized and legalized adult recreational use of marijuana, which just started actually last year. I think they just finished the very first full year of having it legal.
Right.
But they have had medical since the 90s, like one of the very first states. And that's why a lot of this activity was able to operate under the guise of
medical marijuana.
Exactly. Yeah. And so created this, kind of interesting dynamic where, and I guess apparently the region known as the Emerald Triangle is known as like the breadbasket of pot. It's like the most productive area in the country. It's like it's the biggest cash crop of the state, apparently, depending on how you measure it. They don't really, of course, have accurate numbers. So I loved all these kind of, and like you said, the difference and discrepancy of legal, federal and local and state law, how those things sort of like created this very bizarre, when I first went out there, I was like, am I going to just get arrested just by going there? It's like, how does this even happen? Like, especially coming from the very much more restrictive East Coast where everything is illegal and you feel like everything is like, it just was impossible to fathom. And then arriving and then just being like, it was no big deal. It was like right. this very everyday thing there, actually. And like, once you were inside of that bubble, it was a very kind of different thing. So I was very interested in that kind of like the feeling of that, and that this project sort of emerged over those years, and it had nicely been bookmarked because then it was over, it ended. So this, and then inadvertently again, like over time, it's like this now turns out to be like a record of that sort of the twilight zone of, or twilight period of that kind of Wild West era, and now who knows how it will evolve and how it's going to develop. So it was, all the above. Like it was an interesting place to be. Like it was an environment that I was, felt very lucky to have being able to spend so much time in. And it was, all these other, the cultural things. It's literally in, it was like, the title has these multiple meanings, I hope. It's like in the vicinity of legality, in the vicinity, like literally like every one of these like quiet little quaint locations, there's probably a pot farm at the end of the road or just on the other side of the fence or inside this trailer. So like this idea of everything being hidden but in plain sight. I loved, of course, it's like fit perfectly with my photographic philosophy where it's like, you can't really get at things directly anyway. So like, how do you get around to something and speak of it from a peripheral perspective?
Right. Yeah. Do you enjoy the sort of collaboration with publishers like Deadbeat Club? I mean, I don't know if you've done prior books with them in particular, but I know you've worked with a number of different people.
Yeah, I've been really lucky. I've found my work has found its way to a couple different very small publishers mostly. I guess all photography publishers are small relatively. This was the second project we did. We did this project first. We did like a little postcard set called Back East.
Yeah.
Which is something a little different, but that was how I started working with Clint, and it was a great experience.
That's like Clint Woodside at Deadbeat Club.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was I going to ask you? My mind's gone blank.
Sure.
Because I'm looking at the images.
So many things. Yeah.
Yeah. So
then, of course, the hidden book in the back.
So in the back of in the vicinity is a little. A little pull-out book.
That's it, yeah.
Sitting in a little envelope.
Yes.
And it's kind of nice pictures of the buds, cannabis buds, which is a lovely idea.
It's called Flowers.
Yeah, Flowers. Was that your idea?
Yes.
It works beautifully. But also, I suppose, increases the production cost of the book and all that stuff, which we've been talking a lot about books this week.
Yes.
That's lovely. I like that a lot.
I was really lucky that, we both agreed that was like very, like originally I was like, oh, just for the special edition, like there's no way we can make this part of the trade edition, but
right.
It ended up being possible. And he was very excited about that idea.
Yeah. Well, you've got your own. Let's talk a little bit about Spaces Corners, sure, which you have with Melissa Catanese, your partner.
Yes.
And you, this was the building that you were referring to earlier in our talk that you've now managed to to buy. So tell us about Spaces Corners. It's a is it a bookstore primarily?
It is. It's it's strange to say that now because we're mostly not open to the public. Or
you're only open like one day a week.
We have been just open one day a week, but we also are curating a reading room at Silver Eye Center for Photography. So we have like a book selection that's always available there, which is also in Pittsburgh. It's, you know, for us, it's like this kind of, you know, we call it a project space, you know, is for lack of a better phrase for it, because it's like, it's for us, it's just sort of like this umbrella kind of that we can pursue different ideas, different projects. You know, we hope that it kind of is in a constant state of flux. Like we're certainly not, you know, traditional business people in that sense. So, and retail, as many of us already know, like for even for photo books, is just not really a very practical means. Exactly. So we wanted to bring this material to a new audience in Pittsburgh where it was not available previously. Like there was no place that you could visit these books. So sharing our love for photo books. And when we started, it was already, you know, 2011, which seems like a world away already from all the things that have happened since then with photo book publishing and just the explosion of activity that's kind of keeps to continue, which I think is great. So it was like, you know, a moment when that was just happening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess, you know, like you say, you're not, you might not, you know, think of yourselves as business oriented, right, but if you have a space that, you know, might have potential for, you know, running workshops and this, that, and the other, there are all kinds of possibilities that are, you know, in front
absolutely
of you.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and that's what I think, you know, we hope it to be like a way to, in a perfect world, and it has already like provided opportunities and excuses to engage with things. Like, to me, it's really nice to, you know, step back from our own work and work with other artists on book projects or in just sharing, you know. It's also like a laboratory, I think of, is like how to, you know, what are these things, photo books? Like, how can we talk about them better or talk about them to an audience that's not familiar? Like, what are the, we believe they're accessible and democratic and kind of, you know, available. If you're interested in looking at things, you should be interested in photo books, you know. But, you know, so trying to like, on a very like almost, you know, ground zero sort of position, like trying to introduce that topic and kind of bring that to life for other people has been kind of part of the fun of it.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. You're just sharing your passion and
absolutely
spreading it. So like, what would you say are your main strengths and maybe even one or two main weaknesses as a photographer? Can you identify those things? Because it's quite difficult sometimes to... it's easy to find those things with other people.
Of course. Sure. Well, I'll start with weaknesses. Well, I don't know. I mean, if I had to say, I suppose... Well, certainly weakness is that I can never find enough funding to support myself to be in a comfortable space for very long to actually produce. Although maybe now that is part of my work and that's like actually... You know, who knows if I was, I mean, I, you know, it seems like it'd be a good problem to have, but if I suddenly ran into a lot of money, maybe my work would just get ruined.
Go to hell. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, that's my,
I don't think so.
But so yeah. You know, and also, you know, I think I am a bit scatterbrained, you know, so I am like trying to maybe juggle way too many things and my ambitions exceed my ability to actually, you know, achieve those things. You know, I'm always haunted by the phrase jack of all trade, master of none, you know, like this idea of like I'm doing a little bit of 100 things and maybe I'm not doing as many, you know, but I do, you know, then maybe a strength, I do try to rein things in. I do try to kind of focus things on, you know, I try to push to completion projects, even if it's, you know, in sketch form or, you know, there's many stages of my project development, you know, from the raw initial idea to like the folder on the laptop to like printing little zines or booklets and dummies. And, you know, so I'm interested in how something can emerge, you know, like in looking for ways to kind of encourage it, but also allow it to happen at the same time, which is, I think, a difficult thing that we all struggle with.
Well, yeah, it's that work ethic thing again, I think, and it's also that ability to actually finish what you've started, which is a theme that comes up quite a lot on the podcast, you know?
Yes.
That's counts for a lot, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, well, I think the the thing I've come to is that, you know, it's, you know, there's no right answer, of course, for those things. You know, sometimes finish is because you have a deadline. I mean, those are the most easy. And if you can't impose that on yourself, you know, I think of all my projects as somewhat ongoing, even after I've published a book. You know, like I'm hardly ever completely satisfied with the project, you know, and there's always like, I'm adding a few in the background. And I mean, I don't know, you know, like, I feel like I try to maintain as much as possible this, you know, an openness to how things could be. I definitely love the idea of the beginner's mind, you know, the kind of being a student at all times, you know, and I think that's a, you know, a position that I try to, you know, maintain, which, you know, it's easy to do when you are, you know, very insecure and not sure what's going on. And, you know, it's been nice to, I feel so lucky to be part of this community, like where we are here in Chico right now, like, you know, being able to be, you know, and book fairs and like, you know, these moments where you come together and you're like, wow, I'm not just crazy. Everyone else is too here, you know, it's really a community that I'm so, you know, psyched to be a part of. Like, I feel like it's a very invigorating little corner of the world, and I draw a lot of it's very satisfying to be able to share those things in different ways with different people that are also in tune with that. So I don't know if I kind of got a little off there, but
no, that was perfect, man. And it was also a very, very, very good point at which to end it. And I appreciate you chatting to me.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Ed.
I really enjoyed
talking to you, man. It was great to hear you. And yeah, thanks for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.